the turn of the 19th to the 20th centuries, the US Navy's outlook on fleet logistics was remarkably similar to that of the Royal Navy, if at a somewhat smaller scale. The British envisaged logistics as primarily consisting of establishing a vast network of overseas bases from which ships could cycle to and from their stations, restocking mostly in harbour, although a few trials with resupply at sea had been initiated, such as coaling. And of course, all the way back in the Age of Sail, supply ships sailing out to ships on blockade had been done in some areas. For the US Navy, much of the 19th century had been spent as a primarily coastal defence force. Resupply of ships overseas consisted mainly of either taking supplies or supply ships with you and then finding an appropriate neutral or seized harbour, or simply establishing a relevant supply port at or near your point of interest, whether this was by taking control of it directly or by establishing diplomatic links with whoever happened to own it. Like the Royal Navy, some limited resupply at sea had been played with, but not all that much. World War I had pushed the US Navy forward in this field by quite a bit on two counts. Firstly, the deployment of Admiral Sims' destroyer formation to Queenstown, now Cove in Ireland, had led to the rapid development of a small logistical force that supplied fuel, spare parts, food, repairs, and general upkeep to the ships stationed there. Secondly, the massive expansion of the Navy, kickstarted by the various building programs authorised in the latter half of the 1910s, meant that not only was there a much greater chance of a significant overseas deployment in the US Navy's future, but it would now also involve a much larger number of ships. That, of course, meant a logistics train was needed on two counts. Firstly, the number of ports that were capable of serving a world-class war fleet were considerably smaller than those that could have supported a dozen or two ships of a pre-World War I US Navy expeditionary force. And secondly, the main area of operations was now likely to be the Pacific, which was rather large and bare of a land for much of it, and although islands did appear in greater numbers as you went further and further west, most of those possessed little to nothing in the way of modern infrastructure at all, let alone fully developed port facilities. This prompted the creation of what was termed the Base Force, as at this stage the idea was still, generally speaking, to provide a safe port or harbour, a base, from which the fleet could operate. Thus, various tugs, repair ships, parts, and food resupply ships, as well as tankers and the last few colliers, were placed under this organisational umbrella. Notably not under this banner at this stage were destroyer, submarine and aircraft tenders, as they were still seen as loosely part of the fleet itself. And although those ships would become some of the first recipients of supplies brought forward by the Base Forces ships, they would then be passing those on to their respective charges via their somewhat more specialised equipment. The Base Force would often send large portions of its fleet out with the main battle fleet during the interwar fleet problems, both to gain experience generally, but also because keeping both sides of the fleet operational for the duration of the exercise meant that the logistics ships, especially the fleet oilers, were needed. Fueling at sea thus became a regular feature of the fleet problems, although this was often done when the fleet was at rest in between operational stages. Some underway refueling was carried out, but it wasn't thought that this would be a major feature of fleet deployments in wartime, more of a nice-to-have emergency capability to sustain either short-range ships, such as destroyers, or to top up vessels that had been affected by some critical issue, perhaps a ship that had been in battle and suffered damage to its fuel tanks, or one that had burned an awful lot of fuel chasing enemy ships at high speed, or perhaps one that had been forced to sail from harbour to engage in battle before refuelling there could be completed. But the logistics element of the US Navy was then subjected to a series of events that meant much development of techniques was frozen from the end of the 1920s to well into the starting phase of World War II. Firstly, the Great Depression saw budgets cut so much that destroyer squadrons found themselves limited in their sailing speeds in what exercises they were actually allowed to go on, just to save on fuel costs. In that kind of environment, there was precious little chance to practice logistics at sea at all, The fight was to preserve as much of the base force as possible, just in terms of keeping the ships in service. And then, as war clouds began to gather in the latter half of the 1930s, the precise opposite occurred. Budgets massively increased, but with that came orders for new ships, both directly into the Navy and also in the form of subsidized construction of ships like the National Defense tankers, some of whom would be taken directly into Navy service and others would begin life in private hands. New ships, in part, replaced some of the very old and worn-out ships, but many were either making up the numbers of a force that had been reduced by the Great Depression budget cuts, or by the aging out of some of their very earliest ships, as well as expanding the base force past its previous peak strength. This meant existing experienced crews were being moved about and sometimes divided up to provide a nucleus of experienced crew on new vessels, with their place on existing ships being taken up by other green crew. And even when moved wholesale, some of the newer ships were larger, and thus there would still be some green crew, even if an entire veteran crew was moved to a replacement ship. Thus, while the on-paper capacity of the base force began to rise, their ability to experiment with new techniques was quite limited, as they were mostly occupied trying to bring the new guys up to speed with existing practice, and their new ships up to speed with existing maintenance protocols. Another factor that affected this was that although the logistics force was growing, it was not growing at the same speed that the rest of the fleet was. That growth was outpacing it considerably, and many of the logistic ships ordered were either tenders to service the new submarines, destroyers, and seaplanes, or oilers to provide fuel. And with the increased number of warships, most of the oilers were kept busy shuttling oil from refineries to fleet bases, something that would only get worse when the bulk of the Pacific fleet was moved to Pearl Harbor in 1941, as the run from the Caribbean to Hawaii was obviously far longer than the one from the Caribbean to California. This meant that other things, such as repair ships, frozen store supply ships, general store supply ships, and hospital ships, really didn't see all that much of an increase, despite the need for their services going up quite dramatically. And in the background was a separate issue ashore, the need to acquire large amounts of warehousing and other supply storage infrastructure, as not only was just-in-time delivery not invented yet, and wouldn't be for another 3 decades, that system, or something like it, was, and is, entirely unsuitable for a fleet at war. Large stockpiled inventories were needed to be held ready for shipping out to a combat theatre. So, to an extent, it almost wouldn't matter if the base force was given a fleet of its dreams. If there was nothing available to transport from warehouses, there was precious little it could do to help the fleet stay in action. Thus, the overall aims of the base force in 1940 remained similar to that which they'd had for the past few decades, to function essentially as a shuttle service to build up stocks in whatever the main fleet base was at the time, and then, when war came, either to keep up the restocking effort so that the fleet could quickly restore itself after a short, sharp engagement, whichever way that happened to go, or else, if a longer campaign was called for, the small fleet of repair and resupply ships would have to stage to some captured harbour and form a new base there. Actually restocking the fleet at sea was not really anywhere high on the agenda outside of the very limited number of fast fleet oilers perhaps hanging around near the carriers, which had proven to be very fuel-hungry in the various fleet problems due to a combination of their sheer size coupled with regular demands for high speed to either conduct flight operations or, in the fleet problems, get away from enemy surface raiders. There were the beginnings of some ideas, though. It was realised that if a forward base was needed, there would be a period between the arrival of the base force and the construction of facilities ashore where full service could not be provided to the battle fleet, and thus more supply ships that were capable of directly resupplying warships would be needed, and other similar floating infrastructure was likewise required, particularly floating dry docks, as the Pacific Fleet of early 1940 had a grand total of 3 of this type to its name, 2 of which had been built in the 1900s and could support anything up to cruiser size, one of which was based at Pearl Harbor and the other in the Philippines, but both of which would need to be towed at very slow speeds if you wanted to reposition them, and the precisely one truly mobile unit, USS ARD-1, which had been built in the early 1930s, but was only capable of handling destroyers and submarines. There were likewise but two operational repair ships, one hospital ship, and a grand total of two ammunition ships, the 7,000-ton USS Pyro and its sister ship, the USS Nitro. Thus equipped, along with the rest of the fleet, the base force was kicked into action on December 7, 1941, as its flagship, USS Argonne, was in for repairs at Pearl Harbor when the Imperial Japanese Navy's air fleet appeared. Within hours, the base force was facing its first major challenge of the war. Thousands of suddenly displaced crew, who needed everything from food and medical treatment to replacement uniforms and accommodation, and not to mention all the spare parts, diving equipment, firefighting equipment, and cutting gear, as well as other material, that was all needed to support the rapidly ballooning repair and salvage program, a lot of which was centered around another base force ship, USS Vestal, which had been alongside the battleships as the attack had opened up. Base Force would be renamed to the Service Force in March 1942, and as far as the Pacific was concerned, it started the war consisting of four squadrons, 2, 4, 6, and 8, with the odd-numbered squadrons being in the Atlantic. Of these, Squadron 6 was made up mainly of shore installations, various training schools, and small target towing craft and such, which meant it was the other three that had actual ocean-going ships. Squadron 4 was the sum total of the US Navy's amphibious warfare capability at the time, consisting of 7 troop transports and one optimistically titled attack cargo ship, the USS Alkiba. Squadron 2 possessed 6 tugs, one hospital ship, USS Solus, the repair ships Medusa and Vestal, plus the transport Crescent City. Squadron 8 was therefore the actual fleet support and resupply section, which had 10 oilers, of which the Platt, Neosho, and Sabine were fast fleet oilers, 2 ammunition ships, the Pyro and the newly commissioned Lassen, and the general store ships Castor and Antares, and the more specialized store ships Bridge, Arctic, Boreas, and Aldebaran. And that was it, apart from the auxiliaries Argonne, Mercury, Sumner, and the floating dry dock ARD-1. Now, to be fair, 8 more ships were either about to commission or to come out of refit and overhaul, and more were on the stocks. But even so, as a force to supply the entirety of the Pacific Fleet in a war with Japan, it was a force somewhat thin on the ground. Fortunately, change was soon to come. In addition to the new ships coming online, significant orders had been placed not just for more ships of the same type, but also for a wide range of other vessels, including larger floating dry docks, and a number of ships were being specifically laid down for, and general purpose merchant ships being earmarked for, conversion on the stocks, into dedicated auxiliary and support vessels. Squadron 4, that's the one with the troop transports, was actually disbanded, and the troop transports were transferred to the newly separated amphibious force, as it was decided that the service force was about to have more than enough on its plate dealing with supporting the fleet without also trying to pull double duty as an active invasion organization as well. In place of Squadron 4, at least for the minute as it would be re-established later with different goals and objectives, would come the Fleet Maintenance Office, which would oversee the maintenance and upgrades of warships while they were in port, further freeing the service force to concentrate on ships at sea and general supply away from home, while the Service Force Subordinate Command in San Francisco would expand itself to essentially become the primary logistics hub from which all needed supplies could be collected in the continental United States and then shipped out either directly to the front lines or to Pearl Harbor, depending on need. As well as ships, there would soon come crawling along large convoys of towed barges and lighters. These would not be useful for resupplying ships at sea, but they provided excellent mass transports and pre-made facilities, which could be towed, albeit slowly, to future captured harbours and islands, and thus, when they arrived, provide instant infrastructure without holding up properly mobile, self-propelled ships, which would otherwise be stuck in said harbours, and there were also a handy base from which to build up further infrastructure ashore. But in early 1942, all of that was for the future. The lack of supply craft at that point, made all the worse by the loss in the opening months of the War of the Neosho at the Battle of the Coral Sea, the capture of the slow oilers Sarah Thompson and Robert L. Barnes during the Japanese advance, and the sinking of the oilers Nietzsche's and Pecos by submarine and air attack respectively, meant that when a force of surviving standard-type battleships was lined up in April as a backup force should Lexington and Yorktown fail to stop the Japanese advance in what would turn out to be the Battle of the Coral Sea, these battleships were simply loaded up in port far past their technical deep loading points, and then sent out with a wave and a hope that, well, if they were needed in action, by the time they got to the other side of the Pacific, hopefully they would have burned off and consumed enough fuel and food to bring their armoured decks at least back above the waterline. In the event they weren't needed and they went home again, but still. By that point in the war, though, some hard-won experience had already started to filter back home. The aforementioned Pecos, along with the oiler Trinity, two submarine tenders, the ex-carrier, now seaplane tender Langley, and a variety of other smaller support ships, had staged a relatively successful series of rebasings and refuelings for the steadily diminishing US Asiatic fleet as it was forced from the Philippines to various ports in the Dutch East Indies and then finally to Australia, suffering the additional loss of Langley along the way. At the same time, the need for underway refueling to be seen as routine, as opposed to occasional, was underlined by some of the early carrier raids. Enterprise and Yorktown had opened the year with the oilers Platt and Sabine respectively in company as they struck Japanese targets, with the oilers mostly refueling the carriers themselves, with another practice, that of fueling destroyers from the larger capital ships where possible, also being refined as a result. However, one of the features of operations in early 1942 was just how fraught the logistics situation actually was. Most raiding carrier groups headed out with a single oiler. Just one point of failure that, by mechanical fault or enemy action, might doom the entire task group's ships to being unable to make it home if just one thing went wrong with that oiler. Only in March would Yorktown and Lexington manage to conduct an operation that had more than one oiler available, and that was with a two-carrier task force. The Doolittle raid was likewise carried out with just one oiler per carrier group, in that case the Cimarron and the Sabine. Coral Sea highlighted this fast oiler shortage rather starkly, as even with the loss of the Lexington, which therefore didn't need any more fuel, the loss of the Neosho meant that Fletcher's remaining forces could not actually have stuck around all that much longer had the fighting been prolonged into another day, or had the Imperial Japanese Navy's invasion forces continued to advance regardless of the outcome of the battle, since the other oiler that was assigned to the force, the Tippecanoe, had already been completely drained and sent away riding rather high in the water to restock. Thus, the demise of the Neosho had meant the remaining US Navy ships were down to pretty much whatever they had left in their tanks. Of course, hot on the heels of Coral Sea was the Battle of Midway, and here the service force had roles to play as well, not just in terms of keeping the three Yorktowns and their escorts fueled, a job that fell to the Cimarron, Platt, and Guadalupe, but also in the form of the aircraft transport USS Kitty Hawk, which had dropped off last-minute reinforcement guns for Midway's anti-aircraft batteries, as well as the ammunition and crew to man them, plus aviation fuel for the aircraft stationed there, and had reinforced those aircraft with 28 further examples, a mixture of Dauntlesses and Wildcats. In the aftermath of the Battle of Midway, the US Navy now began to go on the offensive, most notably in the summer at Guadalcanal. This opened up more tasks for the service force, which, although growing, was also forced to charter tankers from civilian service on a temporary basis until more dedicated units could be built for the US Navy directly. This was because now, not only were the ships of the service force expected to keep the carrier groups fueled and supplied, as well as keeping Pearl Harbor stocked up, they also had to keep amphibious forces likewise fueled up, run supplies to the men ashore at Guadalcanal, build up stocks of supplies at temporary forward bases like Nomia and Espiritu Santo, and keep Henderson Field in fuel, ammunition, and aircraft. At one point, there were nearly 100 ships and 500 aircraft to supply in the area, in amongst which were four Service Force supply ships loaded up with food and bombs, and the US Navy was supplying all of this with just one oiler at a time every couple of weeks. A perilous situation, to say the least. When the British oiler Bishopsdale, which was helping out since there were, after all, Royal Australian Navy ships in the Guadalcanal force, struck a mine and had to head home for repairs, Nimitz was forced to send two fast fleet oilers immediately to top up fuel stocks and ships, which reduced the chance of other independent operations since these more capable oilers were generally trying to be reserved for carrier task forces and other such rapid moving operations, while the stocking up of harbour facilities and more general refuelling was being done by the more numerous, slower tankers. Almost every anchorage now used by the US Navy in the Western Pacific that wasn't in Australia, New Zealand, or indeed Pearl Harbor itself, essentially consisted of a sheltered harbor and a scattering of Service Force supply ships and barges, with precious little else in terms of facilities at this point. Much of the tension surrounding the early part of the Guadalcanal campaign was very closely related to the perils of the Service Force. With fast fleet oilers still so precious, Admiral Fletcher had little choice but to position them considerably past Japanese strike range, and thanks to the range of Japanese aircraft, that in turn meant that his carrier forces had to fall back semi-regularly to refuel, since they also had to factor in the fuel necessary to make the voyage to and from the rendezvous point into their fuel calculations. That in turn meant that other transports who were trying to get supplies to the men ashore and to Henderson Field had their efforts disrupted by Japanese air attack when the carriers weren't around, which meant the supply ships had to hang around for longer, which increased the total number of supply ships that were needed, since the initial ships being slower to unload didn't mean they had any additional supplies on board, and so the next batch of supplies had to leave the US well before the first batch had actually finished delivery. Plus, of course, there was a need for all sorts of other supplies. Ammunition for various ships was in short supply, for example. At one point, the older destroyers that were being used mostly as transports and minesweepers were informed that there were no 4-inch shells available to restock in the Western Pacific, and only 1,000 3-inch rounds could be had, apart from what was already in their magazines. At least until the Vestal and the Kitty Hawk, neither of which were ammunition ships, were both hurriedly crammed with pretty much every sort of ammunition the US produced at that stage, and sent out. But they would only arrive in a couple of weeks' time. Likewise, the aircraft at Henderson Field and aboard the carriers burned plenty of aviation fuel, and so aviation fuel, as well as diesel for machinery, generators, and vehicles, was also needed. In late August, for example, the Sabine arrived at Espiritu Santo and was completely drained by a dozen ships in the course of less than 48 hours. Then she had to head back to Nunumia to meet up with a pair of slower chartered tankers that she could in turn drain before hurrying back to fuel still more ships. As the Imperial Japanese Navy began to contest the seas around Guadalcanal with surface forces, yet another element of support operations was highlighted. The cruiser Chicago survived the disastrous First Battle of Savo Island, but there was no mobile floating dry dock in US Navy service capable of taking her in the area. So she had to be patched up and hauled off to Australia. Although a huge number of mobile floating dry docks capable of supporting such a ship were under construction, none were due to enter service for at least a year at that point in time. By September, US operations off Guadalcanal were burning approximately 196,000 barrels of oil per week. This is roughly an entire fast fleet oiler's capacity every 5 days, or the equivalent in smaller tankers. And every new ship that arrived, although welcome, only added to that fuel total. Additionally, more hospital ships were needed. The solitary USS Solace had been doing sterling work patching up those wounded in the campaign, and field hospitals were springing up all across the Southwest Pacific. But at some point, she had to make the trip to Australia or New Zealand to discharge her patients to long-term care to free up the spaces aboard to receive more casualties. And without more hospital ships to take her place while she was gone, there would be a marked drop in medical coverage available for the campaign. And although three more hospital ships were under construction, and an old one that had been sold into civilian service during the interwar period before being brought back into military service as a troop transport was earmarked for conversion back to a hospital ship, none of those would be available during the Guadalcanal campaign, or indeed until well into 1943, which meant for the latter part of 1942, your chances of survival if wounded off or on Guadalcanal were very strongly affected by the sailing pattern of the Solus. Helping to reduce the load on the repair and medical side of the service force was, however, the establishment of firefighting schools at Pearl Harbor, as well as at a couple of the more advanced bases. These were still done under service force control, and they helped to teach basic firefighting, unsurprisingly, as well as other damage control skills, to green crewmen who were being inducted onto various ships. Although this was, of course, more time and money spent, it was considered that a well-trained crew would actually save the service force infinitely more time and hassle because they'd be able to keep a damaged ship in far better condition than otherwise, thus paying back their training many times over in far shortened repair times and reduced demand for spares and dry dock spaces. To assist in keeping the logistics mostly in line, two further command posts were set up by the service force, one in Auckland, New Zealand, to coordinate the movements of supply shipping in and out of the general Southwest Pacific area, and another on Noumea, which then oversaw the finer details of where ships needed to go exactly and when. Just how stretched the logistics forces were can be seen from the fact that those two stations, despite their vital role, initially had less than 24 men between them, with as few as 8 officers actually responsible for making all the decisions, and the rest being assistants who got everything put into writing and then transmitted. In this environment, losses suffered in combat were greeted with a kind of weird resignation. On the one hand, a ship that was sunk or an aircraft that was shot down actually made everybody's jobs slightly easier temporarily, as it was one less source of demand for fuel, ammunition, and so forth. But of course, every loss that occurred made more losses more likely through the diminution of Allied firepower, and that in turn increased the threat to the logistics fleet. And in the end, reinforcements would be brought in at some stage, and these would in turn need to be folded into existing logistics chains. Luckily for the embattled staff, there was at least some commonality in various areas of the US Navy supply line. For example, outside of the older Wixen Clemson-type ships, there were only a few types of 5-inch shell needing to be ordered to supply pretty much every other fleet destroyer and the secondary batteries of every cruiser, battleship and carrier in the area, as compared to the trials undergone by their British Mediterranean Fleet counterparts at the time, where they were having to struggle with secondary and destroyer batteries that needed a mix of 4-inch, 4.5-inch, 4.7-inch and 5.25-inch shells. And in the case of the 4-inch and the 4.7-inch shells, there were sometimes shells that were compatible with one kind of gun in that caliber, but not another. And to top all of this off, the service force was rewriting the book, or rather writing a small library of books, on what actually needed to be shipped in. Pre-war estimates on how much fuel, food, ammunition, etc. would be expended by a given unit per day or per week were rather quickly found to be not worth the paper they were written on. So when they were told that a division was expected to face combat for a month, or a destroyer squadron was going to escort a carrier group for the next 6 weeks, they had to work out pretty much for themselves what this would all add up to in terms of supplies used. And then they had to work out where all the stuff they'd ordered had actually gone. Such was the rush back stateside to get supplies to the front lines, combined with a whole load of brand new recruits actually stocking and storing everything, that it wasn't uncommon to find that, let's say, for example, if a destroyer had lost a 5-inch 38 gun mount in a fight, a new one would be ordered, but they might find the gun shield in the forward hold of the ship, completely unpainted, the breech block for the gun in the aft hold, stored under 600 crates of field rations and labelled as an oil filter, while the gun barrel was on another ship entirely, and the turntable the whole thing needed to be mounted on had been shipped to Australia on a third ship by mistake, and the maintenance tool package and sighting system that was supposed to sit inside the gun shield next to the gun was just listed as somewhere aboard one or the other ship. But the intrepid officers of the service force pressed on, and gradually things began to straighten out. The establishment of larger airfields at Nomia and Espiritu Santo meant that especially urgent items and low-volume but high-value supplies could be flown out far more rapidly, and this, combined with rather pointed messages regarding better labelling and organising of things back in harbour in the continental United States, gradually began to smooth things out, even as damaged ships were being patched up and sent further back up the line for more extensive repairs. The Battle of Santa Cruz Islands brought home the need for ocean-going fleet tugs, which it was felt might have managed to save the Hornet, had there been any present capable of shadowing the main fleet. Meanwhile, the Seabees were busily rebuilding Enterprise's flight deck to keep her in action, while the clothing stores, so carefully built up, were completely depleted, even past what had been seen at Pearl Harbor, by the arrival of the survivors from Hornet and the USS Porter, who between the near 3,000 of them had maybe a dozen complete uniforms left. Luckily, the situation was saved at the last moment by help from the US Army, who quickly established a small tent city to accommodate them all, and all the ships that were present in harbour were asked to donate any and all spare clothing and uniforms they had aboard. This incident made Barracks ships, fully stocked for their prospective occupants and with plenty of spare clothing in their holds, yet another item to be added to the long list of specialist ships that would be required going forward. By the time of the Battle of Tassafaronga, things were beginning to look up for the service force. Ocean-going fleet tugs had finally arrived, and two of those new arrivals helped to bring the battered survivors of that engagement in for patching up. And sufficient hoses and other equipment had been procured for every oiler and tanker to be fitted with two full sets, plus spares, which enabled them to fuel a ship on either side, significantly decreasing the overall time that was needed to refuel ships at sea and in harbour. By the start of 1943, the improving situation could be seen in that the worst complaints were no longer about a complete lack of ammunition, food or fuel, but rather that a shortage of refrigerator ships meant that the fleet was only receiving fresh frozen food supplies once a month, and having to make do with canned and dehydrated foods in between until more refrigerated ships could be made available. And so, as the Guadalcanal campaign wrapped up, the US Navy was now fully on the offensive. That, in turn, meant that the fleet would need far more resupply at sea compared to resupply in nearby harbours, and that, of course, would mean yet more challenges for the service force. But that's a story for another video.
That's it for this video. Thanks for watching. If you have a comment or suggestion for a ship to review, let us know in the comments below. Don't forget to comment on the pinned post for dry dock questions.